This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Mehrwan Irani has been nominated for 3 James Beard Awards, but he doesn't have any formal culinary training. Studied business in college, sold luxury cars for 10 years. Mehrwan spent most of his childhood in India, came to the U.S. for graduate school, and became quickly frustrated with the type of Indian food available. Started to recreate dishes he missed from his childhood and often called his mom to ask her about cooking. He was also an avid fan of Iron Chef and practiced some of those techniques he saw on TV. Today, Mehrwan has turned his passion for food into a career. He's the CEO and co-founder, as well as executive chef of the Chaipani Restaurant Group. Opened his first restaurant in Asheville in 2009. Mehrwan Irani joins us now from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Mehrwan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Or as we say here in Asheville, namaste, y'all.
Namaste. Nandri. Well, it's good to have you here. You were actually born in London, right? And then, but you did spend a good part of your childhood also in India. But how long were you in England?
I was there for about 4 years. My mom and dad moved there before I was born, and within a year of them being there, they had me. And then when I was 4 years old and my brother was about a month old is when they decided to move back to India.
So what do you remember from being in London much?
Not much. I have a distinct memory of my brother being born in the hospital, and then I have a memory of the flight back home on the airplane. My brother was in a little red bassinet, and I remember that sort of distinctively, and it sort of came full circle because in 2002, when I adopted my daughter from India, my mom whipped out this little red bassinet, and that was the bassinet that my brother had been in when he was a child. So
Why did your parents move back to India?
Well, they were, it was an arranged marriage for my mom and dad, and I know it sounds funny that sort of old-fashioned, but it kind of worked back then. And even now, you'll still see a lot of, you know, families getting together and sort of arranging a marriage. And they moved to England because my dad was living and working there at the time. He'd been there since he was 15. But once they had me, they both really felt like they wanted to, and especially when they had my brother, they wanted to raise us back in India, sort of really connect us culturally with growing up in India. Because they were worried that, you know, if I grew up in England, I would be pretty disconnected from my culture.
How connected were you? Did you speak both languages? And how much?
No, I grew up with English as my first language. I mean, my dad was, like I said, he'd been in London since he was 15, so he didn't speak much Hindi, which is what my mom spoke. They both came from completely different backgrounds, which for an arranged marriage is very unusual. Usually the point of an arranged marriage is to get sort of two compatible people together. Mm. So my dad was a Parsi or a Zoroastrian. You know, that biopic that's out right now, Bohemian Rhapsody, Freddie Mercury was Parsi, so that gives people some context.
Well, tell us and, more. I'm not going to let you finish that story before let you tell us more about Zoroastrianism and the Parsi culture.
Sure. It's both a culture, a religion, and a community, kind of like being Jewish. And Zoroaster was a prophet that they believe was about anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 years ago. You know, but at the time was the largest monotheistic religion in the world. Sort of thousands of years later, there's only about, they believe anywhere from 70 to 120,000 Parsis left in the world. Mm. And they're called Parsis because the Zoroastrians, after Islam spread through Persia, left the region of Iran that they were from, called Pars, and immigrated to India roughly 600 years ago and brought bits and pieces of their culture, but then really integrated into the Indian culture. And most importantly, they brought their cuisine also from Persia and sort of mixed it with Indian cuisine, and it became its own pretty well-known type of cuisine called Parsi cuisine. So that was my dad, Parsi. And my mom, Hindu Brahmin, I mean, straight-up Indian, North Indian, came from a family of priests going back. So a really odd couple to come together.
Well, especially, as you say, with an arranged marriage, you try to get within everybody in the same caste and that sort of thing. So you live on your aunt's estate, right? A bed and breakfast?
That's right. When we came back to India, my parents were, they were not poor, but they certainly were not well-to-do. I mean, they were sort of, you know, a young couple sort of struggling to make a living. And my dad was blind. He had lost his eyesight to a degenerative disease. So when they came back to India, it was really hard because, you know, traditionally the male in India works and the woman's the housemaker, the homemaker. My dad couldn't work because of his handicap, so we went to live with my great aunt, And she had a bed and breakfast, an inn, if you will, which is where I grew up. And the inn catered to Westerners. There were Americans and Europeans that were coming to this tiny little town about 5 hours outside of Mumbai, back then known as Bombay, because there was an ashram there with a spiritual leader whose tomb was there. And they would come to the ashram, and my great aunt ran a bed and breakfast that put these people up.
Wow. And so a lot of Westerners, including English-speaking people, English is your first language, so you must have gotten to know a lot of those folks as they passed through.
Yeah, so it was very odd. I mean, I came back to India speaking sort of English as my first language, and at age 5 had to learn Hindi and learn about India. So right off the bat, I was sort of a bit of an odd fish amongst my community and even in school. And it was certainly extremely odd, you know, to have all these Westerners sort of staying at my great aunt and me associating with them. And most of my friends didn't quite know what to make of it. But India being India, there's gurus and ashrams and spiritual masters all over the place. So for the most part, everybody took it in stride. But I was definitely sort of the odd kid.
Well, also, I would think, and maybe I'd like you to tell me about this, because obviously these Westerners are coming there so that they can sort of take in this Eastern tradition and perhaps become enlightened, but at least well-fed. But that does generally mean you have to do some catering to their taste as well as give them a sample of India. What was the kitchen like? What kind of food were they serving?
So it was a pretty large kitchen. We had 7 or 8 cooks and a lot of sort of housemaids and servants to look after the inn. I mean, we could sleep up to 40 people when it was really busy. And but very bread and breakfast style. So my mom, as part of helping out, because we were staying with my great aunt, and she gave us a little cottage in the back where me and my brother grew up in one room, and my mom and dad grew up in another room, and that was it. That was our living quarters. But my mom started helping out in the kitchen. And she had to cater to Western tastes. So actually, there was very little quote-unquote Indian food or Maharashtrian food being served. It was mostly food that catered to American tastes. So lasagna, spaghetti. My mom, when she was in London for 4 years, had traveled to Italy a little bit and even learned how to make pizza. And till today, I would argue that her pizza that she made back in India when I was a child was still some of the best pizza I've ever had. Neapolitan-style pizza made with Indian ingredients. So she learned, you know, Western cooking. She was an amazing woman. She really was remarkable how quickly she picked up European, French, you know, a little bit of German, a little bit of definitely Italian, and a lot of English-style cooking. So there was a fair amount of cabbage in the menu now and cauliflower.
But like a nice turnip pizza to kind of end a long day.
Yeah. But it's funny because to eat Indian food, I had to go out, like to my friends' homes, or sometimes go into the kitchen where after serving all the Westerners, the cooks would make food for themselves, and, you know, I'd get a little bit of that or sneak a little bit of that sometimes.
Do you ever get, like, see these Americans, you know, seeking to be enlightened, and then they kind of pull you aside, you know where we can get any good Indian?
That's right. There was a local canteen in town, and every now and then some of the Westerners would sneak out, even though they were discouraged because we were worried that they would get sick eating out at the local cantinas. So.
What was your sense of your identity at the time? I mean, kids don't really have that sense, but did you have a feeling about that? And as you look back, how would you describe your identity in those years?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that kids usually don't have a strong sense of identity at that age. But from age 5, I knew that because I was in such a small town, almost a village, and it was so insulated, but then to have this influx of Western civilization into the middle of this, you know, town in the middle of nowhere, really had a remarkable impact on me growing up. I mean, I grew up reading Western books, Western novels, watching Western movies, having access to Western music. I mean, these are things that nobody in school could relate to or had any sort of concept of. So it sort of formed a very Western identity in me. I almost identified more strongly with this country I'd never been to, America, than I did with where I was growing up. And because my parents were from mixed communities and sort of mixed caste, if you will, I didn't even grow up with a strong sense of my personal religious belief system or my, you know, culture. You know, I wasn't Gujarati or I wasn't, you know, South Indian or Keralite or from Tamil Nadu, where you have a really strong sense of your food, your people, your community, your religion, your holidays. We were catering constantly to Western ideas. I mean, we celebrated Christmas at my house, which I guarantee was probably the only household that celebrated a Western-style Christmas where I was growing up.
What sense did you have? Did you imagine your future, and what was that?
I always imagined my future in the West. I just knew it. I mean, I grew up reading, you know, The Hardy Boys, and well, those are English books, but still, mm-hmm. I had a sense that I would either be in England or in America.
Did you think? What we were going to be doing in those places?
Oh, I just imagined a typical business career. You know, when I finished high school and went to college in India, it was for an undergraduate degree in business and business administration. And I just sort of had a sense that once I finished, I'd find a way to make my way either to America or to England.
Well, once he did, he found his way to marry the business education with a passion for food. Mehrwan Irani is the CEO, co-founder, and executive chef of Chai Pani Restaurant Group. It's the first restaurant opened up in Asheville, where he lives now with his family, and is joining us from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. So, Mehrwan, you did undergrad in business in India. Then
right.
you traveled to the U.S. for grad school, and you went to South Carolina. Why'd you pick South Carolina?
Well, with all these Westerners coming and staying at our home in India, my family and I became friends with many of them because many of them would come sort of, you know, year in and year out. And when it was time for me to sort of make plans for what to do after undergrad, we reached out to some families, and this one family in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, said, oh, yeah, we'd love for Mehrwan to come live with us or stay with us as a landing place. And about 2 hours away was the University of South Carolina in Columbia, which is where I applied for my to get an MBA. And I got accepted. They gave me a graduate assistantship. And so off I was shipped to the South.
You and again, you're thinking, you know, get the MBA, figure out a business, and then there you'd be here in the—
And there it'd be, yeah. I mean, I got to say, Frank, when I flew in into New York City, because that's where my flight first came, New York was exactly what everything I thought America would look like. The skyscrapers, the restaurants, the people. I spent a night there, and then the next day I got in this little puddle jumper and— flew to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and as we were flying in, I'm looking down out of the airplane window, and I'm saying, why is everything so flat?
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah, Myrtle Beach looked nothing like the America of my imagination.
What was it like living there? Again, you've got this vision in your head, and now you're in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, it was a culture shock. I mean, you know, because the South has a very defined culture. I mean, you know, it's not, and especially as small towns. And after about a month in Myrtle Beach with this wonderful, sweet family that put me up there, I then moved to Columbia and got myself a room and a roommate. And I lived on, let's see, the graduate assistantship was $250. It paid for tuition, and that's what I lived on every month. It was about $250. Wow. But then I would drive back to Myrtle Beach on weekends and holidays and find odd jobs. And one of which was waiting tables at a restaurant there.
What was that like? And what was the whole experience like for you? I mean, again, it's one thing to imagine what it's going to be. Now you're actually there. You're going to school. You're in the South. What was it like?
Yeah, again, grad school is nothing like undergrad school. All my sort of, you know, pictures and movies I'd seen of America and undergrad college where it sounded like this amazing party. I mean, it was an over-romanticized notion.
But you were in Myrtle Beach. You could have done something.
Yeah, there was no time. There was literally no time. I was either in, you know, on-campus studying, working at the computer labs as a graduate assistant, or waiting tables in this restaurant in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, called Latif's, which that restaurant changed my life.
How so?
Well, that's where I met Molly, my wife-to-be. She was in California studying, but she'd come back to also wait tables and make a little bit of money before she went traveling around the world. And that's how we met, waiting tables, and fell in love. She left to go traveling around the world, and I was convinced that I had never told her that I'd fallen completely in love with her and that I was never going to see her again. She was going to meet some Italian guy, and that was the end of that.
So it was the restaurant owner's daughter, right?
Yep, I married. Yes, I was dating.
See, this
the
is great.
Daughter.
You've got your family. You got a Netflix series: arranged marriage in India, what Parsi and Hindi, and a Brahmin who cooks the pizza, and then comes to Myrtle Beach and marries the restaurant owner's daughter.
Owner's daughter. Yeah, it was. It's almost so cliche. It's hilarious.
No, that's great. And talk about that, because in some ways, I mean, not only were you worried she'd, you know, meet some Italian guy and never come back, but you just didn't even have the nerve to ask her out, right?
Oh, I did not. Yeah, I was a shy little Indian kid, you know. I mean, that, you know, it's like barely dated in India, had one girlfriend, and then I come here and I meet this girl and I fall head over heels in love with her and didn't have the courage to tell her how I felt. luckily, she felt the same way, and she absolutely had the courage to tell me how she felt when she came back. So,
oh, those till American
today, we joke
girls.
That if she hadn't said something, we still would have gone a separate
for
ways.
Your, like, say you were dating long distance, right?
So when she came back, she was obviously in California, but yeah. You know, we connected, and I told her how I felt, and thankfully, she felt the same way. And we started dating for about 2 years because I, you know, it was a 2-year program I was in, and she was in California. But I'd fly out to visit her, and the first time I got to San Francisco, because she was that's where she was, north of San Francisco in Marin County, I took one look at the Bay Area and saying, "What am I doing in South Carolina, mm-hmm. in Columbia, South Carolina?" So as often as I could, I'd take spring break and summer break and go out and visit her. And then the last summer before I was due to graduate, all I had left to do was an internship, and I'd be finished with my MBA. I went out to visit her, and I just couldn't come back. When the 2 months was over and it was time for me to come back and finish this internship, I couldn't do it. So I quit. I quit grad school, two credits shy of getting my MBA, and stayed in California with her. Best decision I ever made.
And what did you do out there while you were?
Well, after having just been straight through college for as long as I had, I just did not want to get a regular job. I knew I had to finish my degree, or my parents would kill me at the very least. And I just figured, well, let me bum around for a little bit. I mean, this is now we're talking 1993, 94. And I'll figure something out, and then I'll go back to school. So I started importing jewelry from India. I called my mom up and said, "Hey, can you help me? I have this idea." And she sent me a bunch of Indian silver jewelry sort of made in Jaipur and Rajasthan, North Indian-style jewelry. And I'd go sort of door-to-door, not residentially, but commercially. I'd go to businesses, boutiques, farmers markets, and peddle this jewelry. But after 6 months, Molly and I started making plans to get married, and it became pretty clear that while it was, a fun way to make pocket money, there was no way I was going to support a family selling jewelry door-to-door. So that's when I decided to start looking for a real job.
Start looking for a job. And, of course, there you are in a big financial center, San Francisco, Northern California, and you interview at a brokerage firm, right?
That's right. I sort of figured that's what I was qualified to do. And remember, Frank, this is pre-dot-com. The internet in Silicon Valley was just beginning to start up. It was still very nascent. So I went and interviewed with a brokerage firm, and they offered me a job. And they described to me, what the position was going to be like. It was an internship at a brokerage. And I came home and couldn't sleep that night. And just the thought of waking up the next day, putting on a suit and tie, and going to work at what just felt like not the job of my imagination, my dreams growing up. I just couldn't do it. So I didn't go to work. And, of course, Molly looks at me and says, "What are we going to do?" And I said, "I'll figure this out." So I start flipping through the pages of the San Francisco Chronicle looking for jobs. And an ad pops out at me. And it was an ad from a Lexus dealership. And it said, "Our top 3 salespeople made over $100,000, working part-time." I mean, they know how to get you, right? I thought to myself, well, this can't be difficult. And, Molly's like, "Well, honey, do you know anything about cars?" I'm like, "Oh, God, I'll figure this out. I have an MBA. How difficult can it be to sell cars?" So I go over there, and they interview me and hire me, and I start selling Lexuses, high-end Lexuses in South San Francisco. And again, feeling like the odd man out, because the rest of them are looking at me and with my education and degree and saying, "What are you doing here?" And I'm going, "This is great. I love this." Frank, I fell in love with the car business. Yeah. I mean, I loved everything about it. Loved cars, loved the business, loved the people. It just felt like a natural fit. I just connected well. I was a natural born salesperson. So I spent 9 years in the business.
And you were doing well, right? I mean, the ad wasn't that far off.
No, it was not far off at all. I was doing great. Yeah. I was one of the top salespeople in the dealership, moved my way into management. And then graduated from Lexus to working for Mercedes-Benz and loved that too. I mean, flew to Germany, visited the factory. Oh. I thought I was going to be the car guy.
You did. We'll talk about why that didn't turn out quite that way or why you didn't stay. But I'm going to take a little pause here because you did get married, and you and your wife adopted a daughter from India in 2002. Talk about that and how that might have changed your career.
Well, that changed everything, Frank. We went to India. I mean, Molly and I had sort of struggled with fertility and IVF, and went through multiple rounds of that, and then finally, went to India to adopt our daughter. We met her when she was 3 months old. And when we bought her back and we went back to normal lives, that's when everything changed. I was working 60 to 70 hour work weeks, leaving at sometimes 5 in the morning to beat the San Francisco traffic to get to work, and then not coming home sometimes till 11 or 12. I was managing a dealership at the time. And my wife was working full-time. We both had to, just to live in the Bay Area. And there were days where my daughter would be sleeping when I left and sleeping when I came back. And I worked weekends, because that's the auto industry for you. So sometimes in an entire week, the only time I'd see her was when my wife would bring her by for a sort of a lunch break. And after about 6 to 8 months of that, Molly looked at me and said, "We can't do this. I mean, we went through so much to bring this child into our lives, and here we are, she's being raised by babysitters, and you barely see her. Something's got to give." So we knew that there was no way in the Bay Area we could do anything. I mean, for the first time, we were faced with the notion of having to leave. And living in San Francisco is a little bit like growing up in New York. You just never imagine you can live anywhere else. But we started looking. And yeah, that was the big change in our lives.
Well, you found Asheville, North Carolina. How did that get on your radar?
Well, some friends of ours, fortunately for us, had been through the same dilemma about a year ago, and they had moved with kids and moved to this town called Asheville that I'd never heard of. Molly had heard about it because she had grown up in the South, and she knew it was this cool little mountain town. And as a kid, she had gone camping here once. So we called our friends and asked them, what was it like? And they said, oh, best move they'd ever made. They said, here's how they described it. They said, well, if you took a few city blocks out of Berkeley and stuck it in the mountains of Western North Carolina, you wouldn't be too far off. Well, that sounded great to us. So we flew out there, took one look around, and 9 days later, we had moved lock, stock, and barrel to Asheville, North Carolina.
And what were you doing when you got there?
Well, I thought I'd just get in the car business again. I started looking around, and a buddy of mine that lived out here on the East Coast was and still is in the high-end second home residential real estate community business. I know it's a mouthful. Essentially, bazillionaires own second homes in private gated communities scattered around the mountains of Western North Carolina. I mean, essentially, the Biltmore House, which is the largest house in America that Vanderbilt's built, sort of started that trend of, you know, rich people from up north building homes around here. So he got me a job in that business. And initially, I was sort of skeptical. I'm like, I don't know anything about selling homes. And he said, well, you said the same thing before you joined the car business, and look at you. You can do this, and you make a heck of a lot more money. And he was right. So I started in 2005, and it was amazing. I mean, the real estate boom's happening, lots of money, economy's doing well. People are buying second homes and third homes all over the place. Molly was staying at home. We bought our first house, and life couldn't have been better.
And then 2008.
Yeah, I mean, that thing hit my business like a ton of bricks. I mean, you know what happened to the regular real estate market. Imagine sort of secondary homes that were completely non-essential. The company I was working for went from doing $40 million in sales the year before to almost zero for six months. And I saw the writing on the wall. I mean, I Molly and I were sitting and talking about this, and everybody was still in the business going, oh, this will recover, and I knew it wouldn't. I mean, Sixth Sense, my background, business background, I just knew we were in for the long haul. So, and I guess that was sort of the magic moment.
What did you do?
Well, we were driving back from Myrtle Beach. We just visited her family, and it was early 2009, I think April. And we're talking about what to do next. And I told Molly, maybe I'll go back and, sell cars. I mean, even in a recession, people buy cars, right? And she said, you've worked so hard to sort of move forward. Like, I can't bear the thought of you going backwards. And for as long as I've known you, Meryl, you've had this idea about Indian food that you've talked about and worked on. And you've never took it seriously, but maybe this is the moment where this idea you've had about Indian food in America and wanting to do something about it, maybe you should do it now. And I looked at her like she was nuts. I'm like, honey, we're in the middle of the greatest recession we've seen in our lifetimes, and you want me to do the riskiest thing I could possibly imagine doing with little to almost no money left in the bank? And Molly's, looked at me and said, what other time could you possibly take this kind of risk? When things are going well, you'd never do it if things were going well. But right now, when everything seems like it's coming, crashing down, is the best time to try something new for them. And she was absolutely right.
Well, tell me a little bit more about what you had been saying up to then about Indian food.
Well, yeah. So it again all started back in grad school. I mean, I got to Columbia, South Carolina, and started missing, home cooking and Indian food. So I went to the first Indian restaurant in town, which is everything you'd imagine to be sort of in a strip mall and what we call a curry house, selling serving North Indian specialties, half them are westernized. You know, chicken tikka masala, which was invented in England, naan, which I almost never ate because I grew up in Maharashtra, not in North India. You know, saag paneer, which I'd never eaten as a kid except when I went to a restaurant. But that was the experience over and over again. Every Indian restaurant I went to, thinking that, oh, maybe that last one only specialized in that food. Maybe I'll find one that serves normal food. We're all doing the same thing. And for some reason, it just pissed me off. It just offended my sensibilities that this was the best we could do. Because I knew the food we had in India. I knew how remarkable it was. I had grown up eating it, of course. And I'd look around at other Indians that seemed to be okay with it. And I'd be like, how come you guys aren't,
up and
losing your minds about this?
Give me an idea of what it is that we're missing. Has it all been sort of more or less cultivated to a thing that nobody eats in India, or a particular kind of food, wedding food, catered food, street food? I mean, what is it that we're getting that the rest of course, it's a big country with lots of different
exactly.
Foods.
I mean, first of all, calling it Indian food, Frank, is like calling it a European food. I mean, it just makes no sense. You have to be specific. But the Indian food that's being served, it is food that's served in India, but like you just said, it's specifically for weddings, banquets, and special occasions. I mean, the British in India that colonized us for 150 years, this food was to their taste and liking because it's milder, sweeter, more protein heavy. And, when they came back, this is the cuisine that followed them and spread throughout the Western world. So it's not even that it's Americanized. It's just one very, very tiny subsection of Indian cuisine that most Indians only eat at special occasions if they go out. And that tiny little slice of Indian food is what the rest of the Western world thinks of as Indian food, at least back then. I mean, things have definitely come a long way since then. And I grew up eating one of two ways, either home-cooked meals, which taste and look nothing like what you get in the restaurants here. It's light, bright, fresh, seasonal, local, everything you'd imagine it would be. Not even that spicy unless you were in certain parts of India where the food tends to be a little spicier. Or street food, which is, small little bites at street hawkers in every major city, at every street corner. I mean, that's literally woven into the fabric of a day, is little sips of chai and little bites here and there before you come home and eat the main meal. And that's what I was missing.
So it's one thing to say, yeah, I'm missing that. I grew up with that kind of thing. But then you understand that this has been cultivated now in this other culture. So the risk is that there's a reason that we're not serving that other kind of food here, right? Because they've everybody here has associated that stuff, that curry, with Indian food. And if you come up with this new stuff, it might not work.
And that's exactly the paradox. I mean, everybody I talked to about this idea of wanting this kind of food looked at me and says, oh, no, it'll never work, especially Indians. There's a reason why Americans like it this way. I even talked to Indian restaurant owners asking them sometimes, why are you cooking it? Why aren't you cooking the way you and I know? Because there was this one Indian restaurateur that would every now and then send me home with something the cooks had made in the kitchen for themselves. And I'd go like, my God, why don't you serve this? Your customers will lose their minds. He's like, oh, no, they'll never eat it. So what did I decide to do?
Yeah, you decided to do that. So let's talk about that. I'm going to we'll start here and then we'll take a little bit of a break. Molly's urging you to follow your passion. Now's the best time to do it. Buy low, sell high. But how do you actually make that idea and sell that idea? Because you've got to raise some money, right? So talk a little bit about taking the idea and what you did first once you committed to actually opening a restaurant.
Sure. Now, bear in mind, I had, no formal culinary training. I didn't go to culinary school. So my first thoughts was, I have to go and get an education. I need to be qualified if I'm going to do this and do a restaurant serving this kind of food. But that was an insane thought. It would cost many thousands of dollars. I wouldn't be able to work. And here we're in the middle of a recession. That was not going to help anything. So for a little bit there, I thought, this idea is not going to go anywhere. There's just no way I can pull this off. And then I sat bolt upright in bed one night while I was thinking about it and just realized I don't need to go to culinary school. I'm not trying to cook somebody else's food. I'm not trying to master French cuisine or Italian cuisine and learn the mother sauces and learn sort of sous vide and all these fancy modern American culinary techniques. I'm trying to do my food. I'm pretty sure they don't teach that in culinary school. So I called the best culinary master I know, my mom, who had been calling over the years as I'd sort of cooking food for myself. And I said, I got this crazy idea. I want to open this restaurant. Would you be willing to come and show me and whoever I hire how to cook this food? And she goes, well, why don't you hire some Indian chefs? And I said, absolutely not, because I've seen what they make.
It's you, Mom, or nobody. So you called your mom and you asked her to teach you to cook. And how did that work out?
Well, she agreed to come, so I knew I had something, and now I had to go get myself a restaurant. So I put together a business plan, you know, having a business background, I just couldn't help myself. And there was a couple of things. I mean, the first thing I was really curious about is, you've heard that sort of old, you know, sort of urban legend that one out of two restaurants is out of business in the first 2 years, or whatever that is, one out of five. And everybody I talked to about said, oh, the restaurant business, I heard it's really tough. Most of them go under. So I was curious to find out why this, is it a myth? Is it true? I mean, what's the data on this? And when I studied a little bit and tried to find some data, I found out that actually, yeah, many restaurants do go out of business, but many restaurants that do well stay in business and do extremely well. It can be a very lucrative business too. The difference is the ones that go out of business, in addition to things like lousy food or bad service or bad location, I mean, those are the factors that immediately come to mind. But the one thing that struck me the most was the idea that businesses that didn't do well tend not to have a clear identity or a sense of what they were doing or why they were doing it. That it was really, really important to understand and convey clearly what your restaurant is. So when you walk into a place or somebody's describing it and it takes them more than one sentence, if they're going, it's a farm-to-table, modern American, meets small plates, meets global cuisine fusion, it's like, you lost me, right? But when you say chai pani, Indian street food, even if people have no idea what chai pani means, they get and have never had Indian street food, you have a sense. Oh, street food sounds like fun, sounds interesting. I kind of have a visual on hawkers in the street selling fun things to eat. So getting that right off the bat was really important. And then the second part was money. I went, business plan in hand to the nearest bank, confident in my wonderful 150-page business plan and expecting them to go, yeah, absolutely. And it was a bit of a rude shock to walk in and have them look at me and very gently say, this is a wonderful idea, but first of all, restaurants are risky. And secondly, we're in the middle of a recession. We're not loaning money to anybody. Mm. So I think I went to five banks, a couple of credit unions, even went sort of private equity investment route, nothing. Yeah. Nobody was giving us a penny for this idea. I mean, I was going to open not just an Indian restaurant, but an Indian street food restaurant, right, doing something completely different,
right,
in Asheville, North Carolina, population 90,000, of which there's maybe three Indians in the whole city, in the mountains of Western North Carolina.
Right.
So, yeah.
So how'd you get the money?
Well, Molly and I, out of desperation, wrote an open letter to everybody we knew, friends, family. And it was an open letter because I didn't want any one person to feel sort of obligated or under any pressure to give us money. And we said, this is what we're doing, and we're trying to raise money, and anything you can give will help, and I promise you we'll pay you back. And the checks started coming in. I mean, I'm saying like $500, $2,000, $5,000. Small amounts of people started calling us up and saying, this sounds amazing, and here, we want to help support you. And the people that didn't have money called and said, hey, it's summertime. You know, we can come over and help out. Do you need help painting? Do you need help scraping floors, cleaning equipment? And a volunteer crew sort of assembled. And we sort of couldn't give them money, obviously, but we'd give them food credit, and we call it dosa dollars as food credit towards the hours they put into towards helping open the restaurant.
All right, so you've got that. You've got a good business plan, 150 pages. Some of that must be meaningful, and you've actually assembled the capital. But you and Molly also have other concerns. Molly's parents had run a business as well, and she was concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, the restaurant that we both met at, and her parents had gotten divorced over that restaurant. And she saw the other side of it, how hard it was on family life. You know, they worked countless hours and barely made any money. And she didn't want a repeat of that. And also, she didn't want a repeat of sort of the culture of restaurants. I mean, she saw, you know, what a party scene it could be, how much substance abuse there can be, what a demarcation line there is between the people that work in the kitchen and the people that work in the front of the house, sort of the culture wars that happen. All the time it's us against the customer or us against each other was sort of the typical restaurant culture. And she was like, we can't do that. We're a family, and I don't want to go into a business that tears us apart. So we wrote a contract. I sat down with her, and we sat down and wrote down every single thing we wanted to make sure did not happen in our restaurants. Culture, how we treated our people, how we treated each other, sort of family life and being there for each other. And we wrote a family business plan, if you will, in addition to a financial business plan.
Coincidentally, a book came out at the time called Setting the Table, which also helped bring some of this into focus, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and that book was critical. It was written by Danny Meyer, sort of the acclaimed restaurateur out of New York, who's also credited with really introducing this idea of something called enlightened hospitality, which Molly, just the minute she read it, just completely clicked with her. I mean, Molly's degree is in child developmental psychology, and she recognized in that book, getting at the core of what people want and what your employees want and what your community wants from an enterprise like ours. And she wrote the handbook for our restaurant based off the ideas of that book that till today. Now, Molly gives talks. She recently spoke with the BBC on essentially this idea of community and giving back and working with people, working with millennials in particular.
So you've got a business plan, you've got a family plan, and then you get a space in Asheville, and now you've got to train your chefs. Talk about training and how that all came about.
Right. So Mom showed up, and I didn't hire Indian chefs. I hired sort of young. We put ads out on these young sort of cooks that were really excited at this idea of Indian street food and wanted to learn something new showed up. Of the first five people with me in the kitchen, four of them are still with the company and now in senior levels of management and leadership. And my mom shows up. So you've got these young, sort of tattooed, bearded, knife-wielding, sort of, scarred, burns all over them, young guys in the kitchen. And my mom, 60-something, with an apron and a rolling pin, it's like out of a Julia Child's movie or something, is there teaching these guys how to make Indian food, including me. Now, I was pretty accomplished at that point, even though I'd never gone to culinary school. I mean, I'd learned how to cook really well. I mean, I watched endless episodes of Iron Chef back in the early 90s, learning how to cook. And back then on TV, you could learn how to cook. I mean, in the early 90s, you had, Jack Pepin, Julia Childs, and even Emeril, God bless him, the man knew how to cook, and you could learn before it turned into entertainment TV. Yeah. So I knew how to cook, but I didn't know how to cook Indian food, and I didn't know how to cook the way my mom cooked. So that's how we started with her in the kitchen.
So what happened when Chai Pani opened? Because that's a story in and of itself.
Yeah, so we had 43 days to get open because the money ran out. And with $200 in the cash register, we opened the door. It's four of us in the kitchen with my mom. And I thought we'd get a trickle of people, a couple of people every 10 or 15 minutes. We'd be like a little chai house. We'd serve a little tea, a little samosa, a little snack. People would hang out for a while like they would in a coffee shop. Well, the line was around the block. I mean, it was literally holding up traffic. By the middle of the day, there was a camera crew from the local TV station in there trying to figure out what in God's name was going on in the restaurant. By the end of the we had a shutdown at 2 o'clock because we ran out of food and we were supposed to be open until 10 o'clock at night. The next day we shut down at 3 o'clock, and then on the third day we had to completely shut the restaurant down so we could go out and buy food and cook and prep over just 24 hours a day. All we were doing was cooking and prepping. So much for having a family life. I don't think I think I slept in the restaurant on those first three nights.
Yeah. But obviously successful. So any fear that you had about whether Indian street food was going to be popular, at least in Asheville, those vanish.
Yeah, it was remarkable. I mean, this happened literally when social media was just starting to explode with Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And with all the young people we had working and helping for us, word got out quick. It was just explosive growth in the first 60 days. We were hiring people out of the dining room to help us. Literally, customers, if they seemed like they were just ecstatic about the food, we'd ask them, "Are you looking for work?"
I got a job for you. And you said a lot of people, even if they don't know what Chai Pani means, Chai Pani means tea and water, right?
That's right. And it's a cute name, and Indians loved it because growing up in India, it's what you offer someone when they come to your home. When they arrive, a guest arrives, the first thing you bring out is some water and tea. But it's also what you say when you're going out for a little snack or a little bite on the street. Hey, let's go out and get some chai pani, which means you're going to get a little tea and a little snack. But the funniest connotation of the word is it's also what's used to describe the small little bribes, almost like tips, that kind of keep the whole Indian bureaucracy rolling. Traffic cop pulled you over, a little chai pani money, and the ticket goes away.
Just a little something, a nosh.
Just a little something,
it's an Indian nosh.
Exactly. So that's what chai pine means.
Kind of perfect. And you said it is even tracked with Indian. Do you have Indian diners, and what do they say about this?
Well, yeah. So when we first opened, there was none. I mean, nobody knew we were there except for the people who live in Asheville and their friends. But slowly they started rolling in, you know, a couple from Raleigh, a couple from Charlotte, a couple from Durham, a couple from Atlanta, and word started to spread. And now, I mean, there's Saturdays and Sundays when you walk in and you'll be hard-pressed to see a single white person, not because they don't want to eat there. They can't get in. Mm-hmm. Indians are blocked. Indians roll deep. When we show up, there's about
sharp
10
elbows.
Of us.
They got sharp elbows. That's what they say about them. Talk more about this. I just want to spend a second on this because this is a form of, in a sense, radical hospitality. I mean, because you and Molly decide, wait a minute, we can't let this crack up the business, and we want to, and this whole idea of chai pani, which is all rolled up in the ancient notion of hospitality. Yes. It seems to me that once again, we have put lie to this sort of capitalist idea that it's only about the dollar, because you can actually be successful if you put a little heart in your business and care about the people who work for you and care about your customers. There's a way in which that's a business success, right?
You said it so well. I mean, in one of our kitchens in Chai Pani Decatur, painted above the wall in the kitchen, it says mastery and servitude. The idea being that if you want to be really, really good at what you do and really be successful, the only way to do that is this idea of servitude. And it comes again from India and my spiritual upbringing and background, and this idea that you start with giving back and you build a business around that. And when I opened the restaurant, my idea of taking care of people was my family, my wife and my kid, and that's why I did this. But the minute the first employee walked into that door, I knew that that it was no longer about taking care of just my family. Now, as much of a responsibility as one feels towards a wife and a child, that same responsibility was now transferred to that first employee and the second and now the 200th, and every customer that walked in through the door, the mailman, the parking meter guy, they're all my community. And if I'm going to open my doors for business, my wife and I are in service of this community. That's what we're there for.
Today you own 4 restaurants, 1 bar and lounge that serves food, and you also created something called Brown in the South Supper Series. Talk about the Brown in the South Supper Series.
Well, this whole time, I mean, my sense of identity is still this kid from India that grew up with this Western sensibility, that lived all these years in the Bay Area and now lives in the South. I never thought of myself as a Southerner. And I was having a conversation with another Indian chef, Vish Bhatt in Oxford, Mississippi, who's got a fantastic restaurant there too called Snack Bar. And we started talking about identity because he grew up mostly in the South. And we're talking about how it feels. And he said, no, I feel like a Southerner first and then an Indian second. And that really struck me. Like, yeah, I've been living here now for, you know, since 2005. At what point do I stop saying I'm an Indian that happens to live in the South and start saying I'm a Southerner that happens to be of Indian origin? And the more I looked around, the more I realized that that's not, people don't do that as often as they should, because the South has such a strong identity that goes back so far with such a long history, that when you think of the South, you have the sense of, well, this is what the South looks like. And yet, here's all of us that have been living here for as long, you know, my daughter grew up here. We're not claiming it. So him and I started this idea of having a supper series, because of course, as cooks and restaurateurs, you know, our conversations have to have food, and that's where we sit down and talk around that dining table, and that's how we engage with our community and anybody we want to talk to. That's the only way we know how. And we reached out to other people that looked like us. There was brown in the South. They were not either Latino or Puerto Rican or you know, from Mexico or from anywhere in the world that didn't look Southern but were Southern, and said, let's start actively standing up and being counted as Southerners that happen to come from all over the world, but let's change what people think of when they see the South. And that's how the series started. It got this, picked up this sort of traction of its own, and it's, I feel, is an important conversation that's happening around our dining table, and we're trying to invite other people to it.
What's happened as a result? What kind of conversations and sort of transformation, if any, do you see?
Well, I mean, more and more people sort of, you know, at least in the culinary field, sort of raising their hands and said, yes, I'm a Southerner first too. Yes, I may be from Sri Lanka, I may be from Brazil, I may be from, you know, anywhere in the world, I may be from Africa, from Europe, but I'm a Southerner too. I live here, I'm going to claim it. And a number of chefs, 5 of us now, you know, have cooked a couple of suppers where we keep inviting other chefs to join the conversation. So little chapters are starting to evolve. You know, there's going to be a brand in the South. I don't know what we'll call it, on the West Coast, and then one up North. And then last month, or well, in September, Time Magazine did a issue they called it the Southern Issue, and Stacey Abrams was featured on the cover. And there was an article in there about, you know, 30 people that are changing the South. And I got included in that list primarily because of our work through Brown in the South.
I don't have a lot of time. That's true. That was the Time Magazine naming you as one of those people changing the South. You also talked about the ethos that you bring, which has been a successful business model. And now you've opened several restaurants. As I say, I think you've got four now. What happens when you expand like that? What kind of care do you have to take, or thought do you put into expanding restaurants that you may not have to be at all the time?
Yeah, I mean, it's about making sure that ethos you've created, it rings true with your team, because they're the ones that are going to carry that forward. You got to make sure that it's authentic and it's relevant to them. And that's how we've been able to grow. I mean, sort of, we just went back and did a look through of how many people have been with our company from the beginning, and over 50% of who work with us have been with us for 4 years or longer. So they carry that forward. So my job now is to sort of get the conversation started, and their job is to continue that conversation into other communities, and that's what the expansion's about. It's not about making more money or opening more restaurants, and it's about taking this conversation that started in one place and having it in other parts of the country, because it's a wonderful conversation to have.
Mirwan Irani shared a wonderful conversation with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Frank. It was a pleasure to be here.
Mirwan is the CEO, co-founder, and executive chef of Chai Pani Restaurant Group. Join us from Blue Ridge Public Radio, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jenny Lawson was on the board today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.